You're listening to C101.5 FM, The Ha, from Mohawk College in Hamilton, Ontario.
You're listening to a show called Dangerfield. My name is Mary, and tonight my guest is Eamon McGraw. Well, I'm very psyched to have you here, and I guess I'm going to start off with a bunch of questions about the fact that you just recently wrote a book.
Yeah, so this is my second book. It comes out next week, September 29th, on ECW Press. It's kind of the follow-up to a book that was put out a couple years ago called Berlin Warsaw Express, which was about a musician touring Europe in the mid-2000s on the intricate and complex train system over there. And this book, Here Goes Nothing, kind of expands on that idea, involving other members of a band, more countries, more cities, more characters, more dialogue, and explores the somewhat complicated interpersonal relationships that emerge as part of a touring band.
And are there any overlays between the lyrics in your songs and the words in your books?
Well, that's a good question. Yes and no. It's kind of like if there's sort of a sentiment or a feeling that can't be sort of accurately represented by one art form, then I try to express it with the other, I guess you could say. I definitely think there's similar stories that occur in both mediums. It's like, I mean, I sing about touring, I sing about being away from home, I sing about the struggle that's inherent in the life of any artist or whatever, and then I also write about those things.
Are there any books that you bring with you on tour?
Yeah, I mean, I like reading about other musicians. I just finished The Hard Stuff by Wayne Kramer. There's a Richard Hell biography that's kind of made its way around the van. On the last tours I was doing, just this last winter with my regular touring band, we were all reading this James Brown biography, which was really, really awesome. Just stuff like that. That kind of nonfiction and historical writing is usually what gets me the most inspired to get on stage every night.
Have you ever had your lyrics translated?
Yeah, I have actually. There was a friend of mine in London once translated them to Italian, and there was talk of a Polish press translating Berlin Warsaw Express a couple years ago, but I just think that I don't know what came of it. I think that they just found that it might have ended up being too expensive, but I did get a chance to see some of the text in Polish, and it was pretty trippy.
And what's like the rhyming structure like?
Typically, I mean, I like to. I actually don't. I can imagine translating being a really, really artistic experience because, yeah, I think that they're. I've never done it, obviously. I don't speak more than one language, unfortunately, but I can imagine it being pretty complex. It's because you have to try. I've had it explained to me before as like trying to examine something to the point where you're seeing the spirit of the language. And yeah, I mean, as far as I know, a lot of the time that also involves trying to maintain the rhyme scheme, which must be like a really, really difficult task. Like I can't imagine having to do that. And that's like an art form and a form of poetry in and of itself. But like I said, I've never done it. I've only spoken to people about how difficult it is. And, I know that, you know, people that are taking, that are, you know, like PhDs or whatever in philosophy or political science or whatever are, always recommend, having to like learn the actual language that the text was written in before you actually read the text, because it can be so unbelievably different in terms of trying to conceive of the actual idea. And, I mean, that's an incredible thing too. There's words in German that describe feelings that obviously exist in the human emotional spectrum that English doesn't have a word for. So that's really interesting to me. I mean, I went to Japan last year, toured Japan for the first time, and there's similar things. Like there's words describing things that can happen in the human experience in Japanese that we have no concept of on a societal or cultural level here, which is also interesting. So translating, you know, an English work or a Japanese work to English would be, I mean, it would be.
It's like a concept.
Yeah. You're trying to articulate a concept using language that doesn't necessarily describe anything you've ever felt as a speaker of that language. I mean, and I'm speaking hypothetically here because I've never done it, but that idea must be, I mean, it's fascinating. That must be really hard.
And so, what's your favorite book?
I am a huge fan of Clarice Lispector. I love The Hour of the Star. That was a really impacting book on me, just because I think that every sentence in that book is is a poem, you know. It's a really, really incredible thing.
Do you turn down the pages and underline words, or?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, when I was reading that, the first time I read it, I definitely did. I mean, like, I've had my writing described as a word party, and that's totally what that book is. It's like, it's so fun to read. It's like, it's every single time you turn a page, like you said, there's like you're discovering a new world, and it's this really incredible existentialist story. I mean, it's fantastic. And that book, I mean, 1984 is great. The Catcher in the Rye, great. I like a lot of the classic stuff. And then I tend, like I said, to just read nonfiction most of the time.
He'll come knocking when he's ready. You better get the door. Don't let the black holes fool you. He hates the shadows too. He's a thunderbolt in August in a March time rolling hill. He's a winner without snowfall, and your credit that is due. Crushing dirt in those big boots. He'll go turning gravel over to show you what's beneath. Got Atlantic City postcards hidden in his coat. He collects his bullets stored in the shoes down on his feet. Father's house. Who's as quiet as a mouse? With gnashing teeth and iron fist. A yellow sticker on an empty and all the beer is cold. You don't take no for an answer, like a plane cuts through the sky. He'll sell you down the river we are sold.
Used to tour incessantly. What did you wear when you were on tour?
depends on when whether or not you're in the van, you know? I mean, in the van, you wear whatever the fuck you want. But I don't know. As the years go by, I've had kind of a bit of a deeper respect for what happens on the stage. Like about 4 years ago, I stopped drinking before shows, which had a huge effect on my life. And you know, I don't know. Now I'll wear like I'll try to wear something that establishes some sort of fourth wall between, you know, yourself and the audience. So I just think that, you know, the older I get, I kind of think that that's a really respectful thing to do. I never used to have that opinion. Like I would wear whatever the fuck I woke up in.
Well, and speaking of walls, do you have any posters that you carried with you throughout your life?
Yeah, I have a Sun Ra poster.
Really?
from a six night stint he did in Detroit in the late 70s. Sorry, not the 70s. Actually, there's no date on it. But yeah, that's a really, really cherished possession of mine. He played six nights over the course of Boxing Day and New Year's Eve at the Detroit Jazz Center, what looks like a couple decades ago. I have a couple old hardcore posters from Edmonton. I used to love this band called Hijinx. That was a really inspirational band to me that didn't last very long, but put out a couple 7 inches. That's like a hardcore punk stereotype. Like they lasted, I think, for like maybe 18 months, put out 3 records and then, you know, broke up. But I thought they were incredible. Yeah, like that kind of stuff. Old punk rock relics that I can't bring myself to throw away. All that kind of shit.
What kind of stereo do you have?
I have a Technics SU V7 and a Sony turntable that I don't know the model number of. I have about, I want to say like 75 records in Toronto, but I have probably about 500 to 600 back home that I wasn't able to bring with me when I made the move. Yeah, and I'm trying to work on sort of piecemealing them back out this way so I can revisit a bunch of music I used to love when I was younger. Just a lot of free jazz and punk rock stuff that I really miss listening to.
What are your thoughts about like greatest hits albums? Do you think that they are like a detriment to society or a necessity?
No, I think they're great if they're really well curated. Sometimes they piss me off. Like there's that Guided by Voices collection. Like it's called Human Amusements at Hourly Rates, or whatever I think it's called. And I mean the songs on that are all awesome, but for me it's a little bit misleading to people who are trying to get introduced to Guided by Voices because
Bobby Bear just recently joined them.
Well, yeah, and it's like the beauty of Guided by Voices is that the best Guided by Voices compilation you could ever listen to is the one you make yourself. You know, because it's like that band is about having a personal connection and into a place and time that you first experienced them, and the songs are so long lasting.
I feel like this is kind of like a beautiful echelon of punk snobbery, because I would have guessed that you'd be like, oh yeah, you know, Steve Miller, and you're like, oh, Guided by Voices. And but
you could compare that to like any band, you know, I mean, like any band you really love, like so that's why it's a little bit silly to like the whole concept of a greatest hits, or you know, is kind of silly, but at the same time it's like it does sort of serve the purpose of being a really good introduction to someone's art, you know, depending on the nature of what it is they do. But it's like, yeah, I mean, that's I guess that's my point, is that it's sort of an oxymoron to have a Guided by Voices compilation, because that band transcends the concept of that. It's like
I think their last tour was they would play sets of like 50 songs.
Oh yeah, totally. Like they'd have like 11 encores and shit. Apparently, you know, like, and that's the thing, is that and every single person in that crowd probably has a different favorite Guided by Voices song.
Well, and Bobby Bear, who was in that band, so his dad was buddies with Shel Silverstein, right?
Oh yeah, no, Shel Silverstein is badass, man.
So how did you form a book?
It was all pretty accidental. Like, it was something I'd always wanted to do, but didn't really know how. And then I just found myself so bored sitting on the train, touring alone. I mean, I would go like, you know, there's days where you'd go 12 or 14 hours without saying a single word to anybody or hearing the English language or whatever. And so to keep myself from going crazy, I started just kind of giving myself like a you know, 5 or 6 hour quota every day of writing. And then I came home and typed it all out and, sent it to a couple people. And within a week or so, like, I'm not even exaggerating, within a week or 2 weeks or so of that, I had a book deal. And so it was kind of this thing. It was kind of this thing where I was like, in hindsight, I sort of realized that I'd found a process. And
yeah.
And then that's just kind of how I do it now. Like
I read your book last night in preparation, and I feel like you got to the entire point up front very quickly, and yeah. Then you like loop people in for the rest of it.
Yeah, that's totally the idea. You know, like you wanna establish what it is you're trying to say right away, and then prove your point.
But I think. You have a good way with words, I would say.
Well, I think like I wrote it all by hand, and that's how I've written.
Isn't that how writing works?
Well, so, I mean, I think everybody has their own. I mean, some people I know writers personally that still use, you know, typewriters. Like they cannot separate themselves from that sound or that rhythm or whatever. And they just, it's how they've always done it. So that's just the only way that it'll ever work for them. And like, for me, I can edit on a computer. I can work on all that stuff. So afterwards, but I cannot write a book if it's not by hand. Like I find myself just too disconnected to the whole experience. And I need like literally one thing to sort of, one word to become the next.
Are you meticulous in your writing, or do you find stuff like written on napkins or written on receipts? Like how do you write?
Yeah. I mean, I just try to make sure that I've always got, like as pretentious or whatever as it sounds, so stupid, but like a, you know, I've always got like a fucking moleskin or something. And, I just make sure that there's always one around, and because it's just, that's the only way that it works for me. And I, you know, like I tried writing for years and I could never finish anything. And the ideas just didn't sort of get articulated the right way. And I think that was all because I was trying to, you know, type out a book. It's just, and for me, it's just impossible.
About like the format of like Twitter, for example, like the conciseness of it. Like,
I mean, I feign interest in it. I personally like don't really care. Like I find it really tough to give a shit about an idea that someone thinks that they're able to, you know, whatever it is, like whatever it is, 140 characters. So I don't even know. But I mean, I use it because I have to somewhat reluctantly, but yeah, I mean, I think that it's all that stuff has had a really, really negative impact on the way people think and behave, and we're seeing it now. You know, like we're, you know, 40 days from the U.S. election, and I don't think a single person has mentioned anything to do with policy or implementing the things that they're claiming to stand for. And that's all of that's part of the problem. Human thought has become this like totally distracted, undeveloped momentary thing. And to me, that's really sad. But at the same time, you know, I know that people do look at those platforms creatively and, you know, use them as a way of expressing themselves, and they think about them artistically. And to me, that's really interesting. I mean, I know there are poets that publish on Twitter. And in some ways that's like the most extreme version of postcard fiction, you know, which is cool. So, I guess it's a case by case thing, but overall, I find it pretty gross.
And do you have any, like, I have like certain, statements that I'm like, I refuse to like use Spotify. Like, I like to pay for my music. So do you have political views about like platforms like Spotify, for example?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's unfortunate that it's become the dominating form of music appreciation.
And what's your art? Like, for example, like how old are you?
31.
Really?
Yeah.
When's your birthday?
November.
11?
10th.
That was close.
You were pretty close. Yeah, no, I just think that people have been brainwashed into believing that Spotify sells music, and it doesn't. Spotify sells Spotify.
Hello?
There you are.
Tommy, I'm just talking to my friend on my radio show, Eamon. Eamon, Tommy.
Oh, hey, how's it going, man?
Oh, you're doing your show right now?
Yeah.
Oh, hey, hello.
Hello.
Is this the tune you sent me today?
Yes, yeah.
Very nice. It's great. I like the song a lot. I was going to look up more.
Eamon, I sent Tommy Guts.
Oh, sweet. Amazing, yeah, right on. Yeah. Glad you dig it.
Yeah, it was great. Is there more?
There is more. Yeah, that's the.
Oh my God, Tommy, I love that you said that. Bandcamp or iTunes. We were just talking about paying for music, and I spit on Spotify.
Yeah, as do I. Pretty heartfelt way.
Coolio?
Yep.
Yes. Okay. Cool. Oh, you guys have a swell day, and if you have any more links to any more stuff, send me.
Okay, bye, my dear.
Very cool. You guys have a great day. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Talk to you soon.
You're a replacements fan, right?
I am indeed, yeah.
What's your favorite song?
Left of the Dial, for sure. I have a Left of the Dial tattoo, actually.
What?
Over my heart, yeah.
What?
I do.
No.
I do, yeah.
No.
Yeah, I got it. I got it in Kingston.
Oh yeah,
Ontario once. Prison style.
That's great.
Hello.
Tommy, hey, tell him. Ready? Go.
Mary just asked me what my favorite Matt's tune was, and I disclosed that when I was younger, I got a Left of the Dial tattoo over my my heart in a prison town in Canada.
Anyways, I just thought that was funny. I'm like, ooh.
That is funny. What else is funny is that I didn't realize my flower rings actually look like African
women.
Right? That was funny.
That's a
funny bit for the day.
A little warning.
Funny stuff. Really cool. I'm going to get back to you.
Okay.
Take it easy.
Sorry. I just thought that was cute.
Yeah, great timing. Yeah, but Spotify, I think that people have been manipulated into thinking that they're
a music
company, and they're not a music company.
People have revolt. That's my opinion.
They're a software company that uses music to sell their software. And
algorithm.
That to me is what makes it gross. Bandcamp sells music. They actually sell music. They're a music retailer. You know, Apple Music sells music.
This brings me into a joke I wrote last weekend. What do you call a vice president on guitar? An algorithm.
That's a pretty good one. I think I'm gonna write. I might have to write that one down. Actually, algorithm. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's a really sad state of affairs that's become the dominant way that people. You know, appreciate art. The use of the term when people describe, you know, quote unquote, consuming music, I find that pretty gross. It's like, why music has to be something that's commodified and consumed like a can of tuna is stupid. I mean, it's transcendent.
I think it's a process. Like personally, like it's kind of like it's taste, right? So it's like, you know. Like what kind of cassettes did you prefer?
Oh man, I mean, I discovered, you know, the Gang of Four through that way, and like Muddy Banks of the Wish Cob by Nirvana, I heard on tape for the first time, and all that music being in a car, you know, putting a cassette in and like rolling the windows down and being a kid. In the fall on your way to school or whatever, hearing music like that. Like that's how music is experienced.
Yeah.
Like it's not consumed quote unquote, at your local fucking Starbucks on the only playlist that the manager allows the staff to play. Like that's bullshit. And to me, it just undervalues the whole importance and transcendental nature of what music is, you know, and it also is kind of frustrating because you talk this way about it and people sort of look at you like you're this, like a dinosaur or something.
I think a huge challenge is the fact that like oldies is shifting now by decades, right? So it'll be like, oh, this is an oldie station. I'm like, no, that's like the 80s. Like, that's not the oldies. So the oldies is like the 50s and 60s, right?
Right. Yeah, that describes like an actual era of the way music was produced and recorded and written.
And so, what were your parents like with music? How did they teach you about music?
Well, I mean, my parents were 3 years younger than I am now when they had me. So they were right into that stuff. Like it was my dad that first showed me The Clash and The Replacements and The
Gang
of Four and all those bands. Yeah. Because I mean, they were my parents were 17 in 1977. Like they were into cool shit. And, so, I mean, I was lucky enough to benefit from that. You know, I mean, it blows my mind that they were so young, I think now, but at the time you don't really think of it that way. But I mean, yeah, I mean, later on in life, I realized that it was a pretty beneficial, thing to have parents that showed you the value of art, you know?
What are your parents' names?
Wendy and John. So my mom's a writer too, actually. So I should maybe plug her books right now. She was just featured in the Winnipeg Writers Festival. She just put out a book that was the closing of a trilogy that she describes as a prairie gothic exploration of Edmonton in the mid 20th century. And my dad just retired as the acting president of Graham McEwan University. So I grew up in a pretty intellectual household where, you know, art and politics and all those kind of discussions were never off limits or not happening. I mean, I've been surrounded by it all my life. So yeah, I mean, in that regard, I'm lucky because it was never like, you know, it's not like I had like evangelical parents that I was secretly listening to punk rock at night, you know, and hiding it from them. It's always something that I've been surrounded by. And in a lot of ways I was raised on it. So.
And how many instruments do you play?
I play a few. I mean, I can play any keyboard, any guitar. I play lap steel. I play bass in a couple bands. I play mandolin. I play pretty much anything that you're going to hear on one of my records, except for drums and strings and horns. That stuff's a little bit out of my pay grade.
No drums.
I mean, I have played drums on my own records, but I prefer not to. I think it's better if you can track that stuff with someone else.
So when you write songs, do you play all the instruments and then present them to people, or do you like play one?
Yeah, typically that's how it works. It's like I'll record something from start to finish and get it to the point where it's presentable, and then the band pretty much learns the song, and then we rearrange or rewrite it in the practice room or on stage.
What's the song Guts about? I love that song.
Well, it was written after my granddad passed away. Pretty much, well, it's about cancer.
Okay.
To be overly simple, but I think it was just about trying to figure out how to write a song from a male perspective in a time when it felt like a lot of male voices were just sort of silencing the voices of other people, and I think it was trying to write about the experience of navigating.
Well, and our wonderful mutual friend Sheila. So I think, did you not make a video in Windsor or something about that song?
Yeah, we actually went to Detroit and filmed a video. And the concept was this sort of post-apocalyptic world where all the women have kind of just vanished, and so there's this kind of like, it's implied that there's this like Lord of the Flies kind of masculine, almost like prison colony existence, and all these people are just sort of waiting to die, which is pretty dark. But that was the concept of the video going into it. Detroit's sort of the perfect place to film something like that because there's just no art direction required. You just sort of show up and point and shoot. So yeah, I mean, that was a great experience. And you know, that touring that record and promoting that record consumed pretty much, you know, like every single waking minute of last year. So.
Over and over again in my mind, locked in jail and I'm doing time. For the things that I did to you, and all of the bad things that I put you through. Guess we never got to say
goodbye. And I never really told you why. People come together through suicide. Explanations, they all run dry. Say no.
Of a global health crisis where
you doing that's pretty much impossible. Like 200 days a year, I would say, pretty much.
Yeah, easily. I mean, it was for the past 5 or 6 years. That's been the touring schedule that I've maintained, because that's just what you have to do if you want to make a buck. So that's what I did. So this whole transition since March has been really bizarre, because especially now, promoting this new book, it's like, here I am promoting a book about something that doesn't happen anymore, talking about something that doesn't happen anymore. So it's all been pretty, pretty crazy. And, every day is a new head trip, you know? Yeah. I mean, I've done since the lockdown started, myself and the guys that I tour with, and a lot of other musicians that I've worked closely with over the years, like, we've all been writing together, we've all been playing together, we've all been working on new records, but it's all been remote, you know, which has been really surreal too, because there was a moment there a couple months ago where there was an afternoon where I was working on a record, and there was like five or six of my friends and I all across Canada working on the same song simultaneously. Like, I had one person in Edmonton recording drums, one person in Edmonton recording pedal steel, someone in Atlantic Canada singing vocal harmonies. There was a guy in Saskatoon playing horns. There was, you know, like, it was, and it was all happening like from between noon and 5 PM. And it was just this really weird moment where I sort of felt super alone, but at the same time, there was all this kind of creativity happening, but there I was just sitting in my apartment recording, you know.
And are you feeling more or less creative in this time?
Well, I definitely don't have the same amount of time to devote to it, which sucks, but I think that now that I've had to go and get a job, which I, you know, is probably a temporary thing, but regardless, now, you know, my week's been kind of compartmentalized into when I can write or record and when I'm just completely unable to. And that was never a problem for like 10 years. It was just every single day I'd wake up and write if I wasn't on the road.
And when you're working, are you thinking creatively or do you save that when you get home?
Well, there's always wheels turning for sure. But, you know, you definitely like it's, you burn yourself out if you try to overdo it. So sometimes, you know, if it's just the time to sort of be distracted and turn off your brain, you sort of have to accept that. I've learned, like I used to get really anxious about periods where, you know, I maybe had writer, what you'd call writer's block or something like that. And now I've just learned to sort of go with it. I don't think that it's healthy to get too worried about all that. And I think that if you do, you're not going to create anything that's worth hearing or reading anyway. It's not going to be authentic. So I definitely fall into that camp of not, you know, abusing the muse or whatever they say. But that's just me.
And the water. Fuck. Okay, I'll try it again. Last November, I've been standing in the rain. There's been a carnival, nowhere to go. And I shake when I hear your name. At least the weather's warm, so it doesn't snow. And the rivers run over girls with blue guitars, so they're silenced. They'll never sing. They're not delicate. They play them like their drums, lose their voices and break their strings. And I've known your name for so long, girl. I hear them say it in the street. You mother to my world, so grab my hand and shake all of my sheets. To these kinds of things. So I'm gonna raise my glass into the air, tilt my head back and drink. And I've known your name for so long, girl. I hear them say it in the street. The mother to my world, so grab my hand and shake all of my sheets.
What's your favorite concert that you saw last year?
There was a couple that were good. Last year I was fortunate enough to see Power Trip open for High on Fire, which really stood out to me. Over time it's become even more significant since, Riley Gale unfortunately passed away a couple weeks ago. That was a pretty incredible night. I saw Sleater-Kinney last year. That was really great. I saw Stereolab. I saw a ton of bands. When I'm really busy, I probably see 1,000 bands a year. So it's hard to sort of answer that question. But having said that, it's like when you do have really memorable live music experiences, and they stand out to you in that whole slew of music that you see all the time. You know that it was the real deal and you know that it was good.
And are there kind of pilgrimage places that you have sought out to go to?
I've played at the 40 Watt. I've played at Vera. I've played at some pretty great places in Europe, the Grabenhalle Main Room in St. Gallen. I was fortunate enough to play in a lot of Canadian venues that don't exist anymore. And I think, again, as time goes on, I think you're going to find musicians are going to be saying that more and more as these places start closing, because there's not any way to save them right now.
And if you had an unlimited budget, for example, if you had massive stage and all the money in the world, what would your ideal setup be maybe for your last album to accompany it, if you could add any instrument or anything to it?
Well, at the end of last year, we were at the point where we were almost able to travel with our own super makeshift DIY lighting rig, where we would have a bunch of lamps kind of grouped according to the member of the band on stage, and someone off stage would be able to sort of manually control them. That's something that I think I'd still like to do the minute that I can start touring again, for sure.
Best lighting guy in the world is Ian McDonald. He's incredible. He did lighting for Sam Roberts and Metric and stuff like that, but he really...
I would love to, there's someone in Toronto named Louise Simpson that I really deeply respect and I work with at the Danforth Music Hall. If I could pick, I would bring her on the road with me. But
that's awesome.
But that's just me.
It's such a craft, right? It's another instrument.
It is completely, yeah. And I've seen her do some really, really incredible things.
You know what I just remembered was when I saw you with the Water Voice. Remember that?
That was a great show. Yeah, actually, that was probably. I think that might have been, if not a year ago to today. A year ago as of Friday or something, because I remember it being in late September and I want to say it was September 21st or 23rd or 26th or something like that. But that was another show last year that I saw that really blew my mind. That was fantastic. So good.
Yeah. Cause my friends had gotten married on September 13th in Newfoundland and I was there. And I remember we were at breakfast and the Water Boys were across the room. I was I didn't really know from the Water Boys. I was I don't really know much about them. And then my friend MC, who works at the Horseshoe, she brought me to the show at the Danforth.
Yeah, I know MC
what? It was so great. Light of the Moon, just incredible.
Well, I went to that show with my pedal steel player, Derek Anderson, who was in town working on a film that I was scoring at the time. And we just wrapped... and him and I